We've been listening to Nayaz, which is a form of techno-Persian that comes out of San Francisco. They have several things out. They're published by 6 Degrees Records, which does a lot of New Age and international music. And I want to let you know that you're listening to WCOM LP, Chapel Hill, Carrboro. We're at 103.5 on your FM dial. And I'm Paul Nagy, and I am the host and producer of Touchstones. Today, we have with us two of my friends who are going to sit around and discuss the ultimate meaning of life and existence as they see it, or some such thing like that. I think that's a broad enough canvas to encompass what we may or may not be saying, and we'll probably say less than what we mean. So on that, let me introduce Tom Hildebrand, who I know through the ARE study groups from many years ago when I used to go to them regularly, and who still make a nice group of folks to hang out with occasionally. And John Troy, I met for the first time. You don't speak.
Good morning.
Yeah, okay. All right, so this is the joys of live radio when you don't have an engineer. I did try to get all this stuff working ahead of time, but to put it mildly, they really left the motherboard in disarray. Everything was unplugged, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm glad I was able to plug in as many things in the right places as I could today. So so now that we're maybe up and broadcasting, according to the panel at least, let's get started. Who wants to start?
How do you start? Go ahead, John.
Mentioned earlier about the meaning of life,
right?
The purpose of life. My understanding of the purpose of life is to grow beyond form, to be formless.
Okay. To be formless.
Yes.
And so what is form that we want to grow beyond? I mean, I'm obviously becoming a formless in a sort of a sloppy way of being too fat, you know. But I don't think that's what you mean. Does that mean
well,
I'm growing out of my girdle, as I could say.
Right? Yeah, let's you know, start with a word.
Yeah.
You know, we start with the word cup.
Yeah.
C-U-P, cup.
Right.
And is the word cup able to hold 8 ounces of coffee? The word itself.
No, the word cup can't hold 8 ounces of coffee, but the word coffee can be held by the word cup.
Yes. So now apply that to any other word. Like God. Is the word God?
Mm-hmm.
Apply your own name, Paul and Tom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As a word.
Can Paul exist within God?
So then
yeah.
Take
can God exist within Paul? Yes.
So take the first thought. The mm-hmm. first thought is always the I thought. Is the I thought, the I thinking I, who you are, or is the I thought a concept in a word floating in a sea of silence? And that the sea of silence that witnesses the I thought that's there, whether the I thought is there or not, i.e. dreamless sleep, is who one really is. Not the word itself.
Now, Joel Goldsmith talks about everything that we see, hear, taste, touch, and smell with the senses is just concepts. It's all just concepts that we have formed. You know, that he puts it, you know, in very succinct terms, you know, all there really is God. There's nothing else. It's just God. And that if we want to learn to live with that knowledge, to observe everything, all our concepts, you know, everything we taste, touch, see, and smell, just observe it and enjoy it and take whatever comes, good or bad, impersonally, and realize that it is all an illusion, that it is a concept in our head, you know, that we have formed, things we're trying to fit into a cup, a container. Everything is a concept forming a container.
Well, okay. So basically, we're not our thoughts, or our thoughts are not us. The operative thing, the thing that's most generative in us, the thing that's most alive, that makes us who we are, is maybe reflected in our thinking and reflected in our speaking and reflected in our bodies and who we look like. But it's something other, something more. Now, one of my favorite thinking processes lately has been the, as I called it the other day, the a mother of the other is the matrix of the self. In other words, that our sense of self, this I thought, in the practical sense of being a human being, only exists within the nests of other people, others who take care of us. And of course, the first other that takes care of us is mama. So we can think of that. But the thing is here is, but what happens is we get inverted to thinking that I comes first. You know, I'm first. I'm first, which is the sort of egotism. And then egotism is, you know, is also the root of much evil in the world, or much suffering in the world, where I take my good over the good of others, or I think my good is more important than others' good. So we can say that's an old insight, but of course we're still stuck with being who we are. We're still stuck with this I, and at whatever level of cosmic significance we want to give it at this instant. And so the question here is, and this is a practice from Tibetan Buddhism that's part of their tradition called mind training, which basically is the simplest form of it, which is the way only way I really want to deal with it right now, has to do with eventually automatically putting the other first. In other words, the other where the I is, and have the I as derivative of the other. So what you do in a breathing exercise, sort of like a Jesus prayer, you say, may all others, when you breathe in, you say, may all the suffering and the misery of the world that others feel, may I take it in and transform it. You know, may I bring it in and take it, relieve them of this misery that they feel, you know. Because, you know, they're the ones who've made me. They're the ones that have cared for me. So they feel any stress or any difficulty, let me take that away from them and bring it into myself. And when you exhale, you say, may all others feel good and feel healthy and feel comfortable and be contented and be happy, right? So you, in other words, so you have these kinds of thoughts or these kinds of things, and the idea ultimately is to transform this I thought into the other thought. So the other is first, and the I is derivative of that. And the only way that the I finds itself is in the service of the other. And there, so you have this natural, deep reciprocity going. So, you know, I'm not like that. I'm an egotistical bastard like everybody else, most of the world. But I like the idea. I like the idea of this thing, because as much as I might think all these others are going to walk all over me and make my life miserable, you know, in some ways I could say I'm actually sacrificed. I recognize that without their good, I have no intrinsic good. You know, and it's also recognizing within that that there really is, there's a deeper unity where this I and the other are primordially the same or one in some sense. Now, okay, I'm just bringing that up as a sort of another glyph
on
this I that you're talking about.
That statement I is never, ever, ever enlightened. It is an insentient rascal to begin with, and it'll be an insentient rascal when it goes away, and it is not permanent, and it is...
There's just the bigger insentience to other little insentience? Is that it?
It's
so much for gestures over the radio, Tom.
It's objective. It's objective that's witnessed by your true self, and we get confused and identify with the I thought, then that inherently identifies with a body and mind and form, which is impermanent.
Which is dualism.
And which is carnal. That's a carnal paradigm. It's sometimes referred to as a horizontal paradigm. We've just got a yesterday and tomorrow on it.
Mm-hmm.
But a more enlightened paradigm is where thoughts and concerns of yesterday and tomorrow are released and surrendered to abide not as the I thought, but to abide as that which is prior to the I thought and that within which the I thought arises.
Okay, so what would we say that is, Tom? You want to?
Well, I was just, I agree in principle with that, but I just have to, I've got a very small mind, so to speak. I'm not an intelligentsia. So I just have to get it down into simple terms. And for me, it's the knowledge that there is a greater, let's just call it something. We can call it God. We can call it the implicate order, whatever we want to call it, spirit. Something that if we'll trust it, it will take care of us, just the way that the animals, know when to grow extra fur. Do you think they figure out, I got to grow extra fur? They just know it. They know. So they're a part of this same something that's taking care of them. The difference between them and us is they trust it. They're living in the now. They're doing what they're given to do, whether it's gathering nuts or flying south or whatever. Whatever they are given to do, they have learned to trust that source of being.
Mm-hmm.
We have removed ourselves from it. We have taken responsibility that John and I had talked before one time about the big eye and the little eye.
Mm-hmm.
The big eye is this everything that is, always will be.
Mm-hmm.
The little eye is when we separate and see ourselves separate and apart from that big eye. So that's what we have done basically as human beings, is separate ourselves from that big eye. And Joel Goldsmith even says that we're bearing false witness against our neighbor, our people we meet on the street, if we look at them and even consider them as good humans. Because we need to look at them and realize that they're, in fact, spiritual beings, an aspect of God that are just happen to be showing in this form that they are in right now.
Yeah. So everybody is a shining star,
everyone.
An infinite possibility that is a unique essence of bliss that nothing else can be possibly like it. There's in the your most original face, there is nothing that can possibly even measure you, much less describe you in terms of the beauty that you are. Wonderful, wonderful. Of course, I'm calling that other, but that's neither here nor there.
There is no other.
Exactly. There is no other in this sublime sense of unity that one has, and it is pre-thought. It's definitely thinking of nothing does anything, it stinks up this idea, clouds it over, confuses it, causes it to divide and multiply.
it's a paradigm shift.
Yeah,
a paradigm shift. You see something one way, and then it can be seen another way.
Yeah.
And the ultimate paradigm shift is from a mortal perception to an immortal perception.
Mm-hmm.
And that begins with literally turning inside out. And by that, I mean that as we're coming up, we start to learn or be educated that who we are is a result of the biology and the world, and that we precipitate, the sense of being precipitates from the body, mind, and the world. The paradigm shift flips that around. Yeah. In a sense, it's creationism in its purest sense, in that from the infinite silence and peace emerges the I thought, then the body and mind, and the world, and it dissolves back into that silence, so that who we are is the greater, not the lesser. And lesser can never know that truth. It's like putting the Pacific Ocean in a jar.
Yeah. It's a tight fit. But there is a thing here, though, which is, in some ways, if we go around and we're creatures of our experience, what I know, what I see, what I hear, what I do, what I think, what I feel, at whatever levels, we're stuck. We're stuck in our limited perspective. I'm stuck in, seeing the world through these imperfect eyes that I've got, seeing everything from my limited perspective, And you guys, likewise, in your own way, have a different perspective because you have a different set of experiences.
Everybody's perspective is different.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody sees a different world.
Right.
Everybody is creating a different world.
Right.
The only way you can get away from that is to get back into that oneness, like John was talking about. Just get into a
Well, that's the question.
Stillness.
How do you get unimprisoned by your experience, by my point of view, by the gravity of my selfedness and my experiencedness and my sensitiveness?
Relinquish doership. Because doership involves a body and mind to carry out its executions. So if you relinquish doership, then it puts the narrator I in the middle of the head out of a job. If you put a capital M on the mystery, sooner or later you're out of a job.
What do you do to relinquish doership? I mean, the Bhagavad Gita says that right on. It says, nothing's happened. Everything is sublime and peaceful, right? All the world is God. That's what Krishna says at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita,
Put a capital M on the mystery and trust it.
Yeah.
And that's true faith, and that's true for atheist or theist. It doesn't matter.
But I'm a prisoner of my experience. You're still telling me to trust what,
You have to start doing it, Bill, little by little. I mean, it's through your study.
Little babies.
You have to start applying it. I mean, you can read about water all you want to, but unless you actually start drinking it, it doesn't do you any good.
That's
you
right. So exercise would be a better
example. You have to apply it.
There's a line in Be Here Now I read years ago. Painted cakes do not satisfy hunger, and I was reading all the books and everything, so that was a signal to go out in the world
and find a thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, actually, that reminds me of one of my favorite stories. I hope I haven't bored both of you with it before. I think probably Tom's heard it though. Which is it was a story that came out of Yoga Vashista, who I might be talking about on the last show that I do in this series, coming up in a couple of weeks. But I was giving a talk on Yoga Vashista, and I sort of put these two stories together. One of them was about the scholar who, as a young boy, heard stories of the jewel of all fulfilling wisdom, right? And all he ever wanted, you know, so he just really became interested in this story about, you know, who had it and what magical properties it had, how beautiful it was and how secret it was, how mysterious it was, how it was hidden away, you know, here, and Phoenix carried it, and you know, and bandits hid it, and, you know, and it still went on and on. You know, it's all these stories, you know, he'd heard, he hung out in the tavern, you know, to hear various travelers' tales about the Jewel of Well Fulfilling Wisdom. And he sat and he scribbled down all the stories, and he, you know, so one day he had a dream. In the dream, he was standing in a stream, and on one side of the stream was a desert, and the other side of the dream was a stream was a garden. And he was standing in the stream, and he, over in the garden there was a tree, and from the tree was all these jewels hanging down like ornaments, like fruit, ripe fruit on this tree. And he went to pick one of these ornaments, and immediately fell down in the stream and woke up. Said, "Ooh." So he thought about that for a while. He says, you know, he says, I got to live. You know, I got to actually go find this jewel. I can't, I've been just thinking about it, just, you know, writing stories about it isn't enough. So he goes out that day to, you know, leave his house, and he makes arrangements, you know, for various people to pick up stuff and do things. And he walks out in this doorway, and he falls over this door sill. Right? He lands right on a path, and there's this little rock stand right there, right in his eyes, in front of his eyes, almost knocked his nose off. And he looks at this thing, and he's just no ordinary rock. And he says, you know, this could be the jewel of all fulfilling wisdom, you know, but you don't find it on your door sill. You know, you got to, you know, go out into the world and find it, where the secret places where it might be hidden, you know. You know, so he throws the rock, and it lands in a little pile of wood, and he goes off and has many adventures which aren't germane to this story. So it so happened that the woodcutter came by and was going to pick up the wood and resell it and resort it, and he dragged it home. And as he was dragging it home, his wife was helping him, sort through the wood pile. And, of course, she noticed this rock in the wood, you know. She says, what's this, my stupid husband? He says, he's not bright enough to do anything else for a living but cut wood. And here he is adding rocks to the pile. You know, he could have carried a lot more wood if he wasn't carrying this rock around. So she goes up, and she's going to throw the rock at him. And she notices as she's about to throw the rock at him that this rock had some special magical properties. And immediately all of her dissatisfaction was changed, and she could be perfectly happy with what she was doing. And so, needless to say, the woodcutter and his wife became extremely wealthy and happy and lived a wonderful life. Needless to say, the scholar has all sorts of adventures, ends up in all sorts of predicaments, ends up, you know, being sold into slavery, when he's a slave working as a scribe for somebody, he hears that, you know, back in his village where he was born, that there was rumors that somebody there actually had the jewel of fulfilling wisdom. It was living high off the hog. So he eventually buys his way out of slavery, makes his way at home, and goes and visits the woodcutter, who's now considered one of the village wise men. And he says to the guy, he says, you know, maybe you remember me when I was a kid, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the woodcutter says, oh, yeah, I remember you. Yeah, you went off to look for this thing, you know, that you thought was so wonderful. Yeah, he says, well, he says, you know, I hear that, you know, that somebody around here might actually have it. You know, he says, and if they did, I would really like to see it because I've never seen it. You know, I want to know that it's real, even if it ain't mine, you know. So he goes, and the woodcutter says, well, this is what I think you mean. And he holds out this stone. And, of course, the scholar looks at it, and he thinks to himself about that stone that he'd found on his sill. It was right outside his door. And he starts to cry, and he says, you know, he says, I held the stone in my hands one time, and I didn't accept it. I wouldn't accept it, and I threw it away. And the woodcutter said to him, well, then, it must be yours. Take it.
The jewel of self-realization is a secret jewel in the hearts of all, and is not easily recognized, because the bundle of thoughts obstructs our vision. And
sounds good.
often when we begin to see the jewel, we see it in an apparent other. It may start off in a book. It may be another person or a saint. It might be something in nature that happens. But eventually we discover that that's all a reflection of the same said jewel within our own self. And to be that jewel, to take the responsibility to be that and live that and hold on to that in the heart. Wear rough clothing, as Lao Tzu says, and keep the jewel in the heart.
And, yeah.
As we go looking, we egoically, the hunt begins early with food, money, and sex.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that doesn't do the job, then we take those same...
I think it's power, prestige, and whatever else.
No, food, money, and sex won't do it. So so then we start looking at spiritual matters, and we want to know or own it just like the food, money, and sex, but you can't.
Mm-hmm.
You can see the reflection. You can't own what you already own. You can't get what you already got. Mm-hmm. It's already.
So what do you think, Tommy? You agree with that, right?
I do. I mean, basically, we are what we're looking for, you know, but we're so much more than we think we are.
So
we're all absolutely wonderful creator beings.
Mm-hmm.
Every single soul on this planet is a wonderful portion of God with the same capabilities that we ascribe to God. But we're limiting ourselves with our bundle of thoughts, with who we think we are. We're limiting
ourselves. Or the things we need to do or have to do to
make
things happen.
Well, look how comforting being busy is, having something to do. I mean, if you'll just get out there and get busy, it comforts us because we're busy. You know, that is actually a distraction. You know, we're out here working in the play, distracting ourselves from perhaps what we really ought to be doing. You know, you can be busy in the garden or whatever, but with the mindset of who we really are, then you're really, you know, you're being in the now. You can never be tomorrow and yesterday. It's always right now.
So it's not so much busy as distracted, just distracted from this being who we are. So let's this is like a true contentment. You know that there's a true deep self acceptance.
Well, you know, there's
a kind of self
myself here.
Okay.
Now I can, when I get into flow, when I know that I am connected into Source, there is just absolute.
You immediately slipped out of that.
There's just absolute peace, and I go. Uh-huh. And when I go, when I'm realizing that everybody I'm with and I'm around is also a portion of that, and that we're all just doing our thing and trying to understand who we are. People respond to it. I mean, I can see the changes in people just my presence makes, you know. But I can also, when I'm out of that flow, you know, I'm just out there by myself running around wishing I was this, wishing I was that. But you have to connect in with the flow, realize who you are, and be still and be quiet and trust it. It's not trusting yourself. You're trusting it. And that's with a capital I.
Again, I have to go back to the fundamental frustration of Mr. All I Am is What I Know, and I don't seem to know what you're talking about, so how can I possibly approach this?
You can't know it. Knowing is relinquished in the bridge
the doing is
to the unknown. The unknown remains unknown. It doesn't, that doesn't detract from the divine at all. Being the divine rather than knowing the divine, the organ of knowledge is the brain.
Mm-hmm.
There's a knower and knowledge. That's duality.
And what's the organ of being?
The organ of being is causeless and pre-existing, beginningless and without attributes. So as long as we're looking for something to define, hold on to, label, see, know, own, join.
They're all measured.
Beliefs.
They're all limited. They all have beginning.
All of the work of the mind. And mm-hmm. So true faith is the antithesis of belief.
Mm-hmm.
It is the substratum that the mind plays in, like the screen of a movie, and who we are is more like the screen of the movie than all of the noise and rainbow shadows that are playing on the movie that seduces us into thinking that is real.
Okay, so you're saying it's some kind of dimensionless, pre-existent, pre-experience.
And ever-present.
That's ever-present. Well, that's sort of like, you know, it's sort of the blatant obvious that that I overlook all the time.
It's the constancy. The constancy gives rise to its being unnoticed.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, you know, you have to try to find, number one, realize the truth. Realize that you are separate when you're out here in this world. When you start reading and learning about it, then you can start trying to, like you're asking, what can I do about it? How mm-hmm. can I find this place?
Mm-hmm.
And you meditate.
Yeah,
and you read. And
finding it seems to be not finding it. In other words, it seems that you're stuck. As long as I'm in some kind of experience, I'm not experiencing
my
this.
My goal right now is to know nothing. To absolutely be quiet and know nothing.
Maybe that's why he's not so talkative on the show these days. It's just that natural humility exuding. Maybe that's the reason why I'm ceasing production of the show. I want to go back into the silence. But
there's little one can do.
Yeah.
The mind is not the tool mm-hmm. for self-discovery. It's like trying to walk with your arms. Mm-hmm. It's just the wrong.
You can do it if you
equipment.
Do it if you have to, but it doesn't. It takes a while to get used
you
to.
You can do it yeah. through simple self inquiry, mm-hmm. but there are not many people who have the qualities to be able to do that. To really take the mind and turn it and look for the I thought,
and
it'll disappear.
In on itself, and it disappears into this quiet pool of
into
pure
stillness.
Consciousness that's still.
Yeah, Jesus wasn't
and accepting.
When Jesus was teaching, he wasn't bragging when mm-hmm. he said, "Be still and know I am God." It was an instruction to
right.
all of us to be still and know that truth.
Right. Yeah.
So it's in the stillness that being can take its rest, and the sense of being itself trumps the I thought every time, because the I thought arises from the sense of being and then fades back in and disappears into the sense of being.
Yes.
It happens every night in dreamless sleep,
mm-hmm.
that process. But when you say you had dreamless sleep, there was awareness to tell you that you had dreamless sleep.
It just wasn't recording any experiences that I thought were worth remembering. You know,
it was just quiet.
The big blank, the big blank, timeless blob, which is what a lot of people think death is. You know, we just go into endless, dreamless sleep. It's not so bad.
Not bad.
Not so bad.
Well, they haven't read all those near-death experiencer books then.
Mm-hmm.
The reports from the people who die and have flat lines on the EEGs
mm-hmm.
are pretty similar. You know, they meet this being of light. They go through a tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is wonderful, love. They get to review their past life, and that past life review is just the current experience they've just led. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's not the all in all.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are reports of some that who do go on into the beingness, you know, from that. But the majority of those past life experiences people report, or near-death experiences people report, it's just a review of their most recent life and how
mm-hmm.
it affected their individuality.
Sort of how they got there, yeah.
Is the aspect of the soul that they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's... And also, there's also all kinds of stories out of the literature about people seeing complete new worlds, with beautiful buildings, shimmering lights, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've not personally experienced that, but I've read enough about it that I believe it's possible,
mm-hmm.
you know, that one day I might be blessed with going into that. Now, I've had my own experience. John has had experiences. It's our consciousness limits us, our belief patterns, that little energy pattern of who we think we are, limits us. Education, hopefully, this type of education, is to begin to remove those limits on who we think we are and to just learn to trust in that beingness.
Part of releasing those limits is that, and I learned this in my tenure with Swami Muktananda, who took me through an intense sadhana of going through mystic visions, going to celestial worlds, going to what he calls Siddhaloka, that these experiences come and they go. And there is a danger because
you get addicted to them.
We start to see one experience as more sacred than another experience. And then that takes away from our understanding because
all
true surrender, true faith brings you back to the ordinary, just like Dorothy goes back to Kansas and everything is ordinary and all the magical characters are still there and it's magical and she accepts the ordinary as sacred. And so the problem with the visions and things is we start remembering them. They take a precedence over attention in the here and now. So the saints and sages of India warn against it. They would prefer a devotee who would bypass that altogether.
So in other words, it's sort of like you don't need those experiences of heaven worlds or hell worlds. What you need is the profound deep acceptance of wherever you are that is there.
Yes.
You know, so, and, well, of course, then this deep equanimity of some saints, this would mean that, you know, you could be perfectly comfortable being a homeless person as well as being a king.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if, I haven't quite reached that thing. I'm still worried about being homeless and, you know, being a king. Well, I don't want to be no king, but, you know. I don't want to be having to hassle as much as I might have to hassle. Of course, I might get more exercise if I was homeless. Maybe that would be good for me. So maybe I'm headed for homelessness after all.
We're on the radio here, and let's say you're narrating a game, and you narrate the game, and you get excited, and you might root, and then you say, "Oh no, he dropped it," or whatever
the ball,
you go through.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's all very interesting and emotionally charged, but the narrator doesn't change the outcome of the game one iota.
He's just talking about what's going on.
Same is true with that voice in your head. It's just a narrator eye. It's a second guesser.
But he does color how you experience what you see or hear.
He gets it right half the time.
Yeah.
It's a second guesser.
Yeah, second guessing what's going on. Yeah. And of course also the narrator then also thinks that. I mean, often we probably confuse our experience with our narrative of our experience. You know, we have our direct experience, but we're so busy re-narrating it ourselves, you know, remembering it, reconstructing it.
There's a term called synchronicity, which is that, you know, there are no accidents.
Right, yeah, it's causal events that have symbolic significance, which may or may not have any causal relationship.
Synchronicity always shows up uninvited. It shows up when we least expect it. And the common denominator of all synchronicity is non-doership. There's no sense of doership in it.
Yeah, well, there's a number of people floating around because they also see the synchronicity as an aspect of flow or creativity, and so they're seeing that the synchronicity, they want to cultivate synchronicity as a way of cultivating creativity and flow.
That's faith.
Yeah, and but the. Now, what I see an aspect of synchronicity or just seeing these symbolic interactions of things, which aren't necessarily causal, is that I see that as a thinning of the veil of ourself. In other words, our self ego here, I mean, I'm talking about the ego, is normally tied into our sensate experience, which is exteriorized into a kind of a very sort of limited and linear sense of time and space, which we call, you know, everyday life. And with when synchronicity starts going around, then all of a sudden that linearity starts having, you know, a number of feedback loops and starts...
goes vertical.
It goes
from
verticals.
Horizontal to vertical.
Yeah, and verticality is a whole different ball of wax. I mean, its sense of causality is not, domino hit domino, but rather it goes forward and backwards and all
eternal,
sorts of things.
Eternal now.
Yeah.
It is that vertical paradigm.
And it never runs out of the beginning and it never runs out of the end.
That's correct.
You know, it just keeps happening without anything moving. And it's a weird, fascinating place to be.
And if you look at an equation like E equals MC squared, energy equals matter. If you're on the E side of that equation,
mm-hmm.
in the now, in a vertical paradigm,
mm-hmm.
there are no nouns left.
Mm-hmm.
If there are no nouns left and you inquire, who am I, there's no noun to hang on to anymore. So that who am I falls to the state of I, not the statement, but to the infinite awareness that everything is written on, that everything is a hologram within.
It is aiety, and we'll call it the aiety.
Aiety.
the aiety.
In that holographic universe that I mentioned earlier, the author, Michael Talbot, was talking about, scientists have now shown that when you put all these electrons and stuff together and form a plasma, the whole group of them, it has its own consciousness. The whole group functions with a consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to individual actions. It is a consciousness of the whole.
Yeah, well plasma is one of the words we use for fire, for energy or electricity. You know, it's the stuff of energy. You know, this stuff. Well, and what's interesting though is that this there is a kind of infectious quality to this consciousness. In the sense that at one level, this seems all highfalutin and has nothing to do with our everyday life. And at another level, consciousness can drift down and it can make you like less reactive, so that when someone does, you know, someone who's angry greets you with anger,
you can
instead of reflecting back mindlessly the same anger that they're showing you, or reflecting back fear or something else reactive, you can accept it, and you can also return it. And in return, if you return somebody's anger with true equanimity and love, you disarm them.
You take it out of the universe.
What happens is suddenly it's sort of like what's burning the anger for them suddenly has no things. Now, if they really identify with their anger, they're not going to like you very much, because they, you know, that you suddenly disempowered them and they have to rush off and get angry at somebody else who's more reactive than you. But if they're, you know, if they're not happy with being angry anyway, then all of a sudden they're grateful, not knowing exactly why they're no longer feeding on it. There's no longer this feeding frenzy going on inside themselves, you know.
I like to keep it simple and just remind myself to put up thy sword, you know, and not to fight it. As we fight things, we energize them and create them, give them life in this illusionary reality.
As you guys know, in another context, my hobby is tarot reading, and the tarot, you know, swords are, you know, the stuff of air, but they're also they're the stuff of thought and of words. And so a lot of where conflict comes is in this sort of battle of the winds. You know, there's there's not a lot of substance in wind. I mean, there's definitely some, but there's not a lot. But you can never quite pin it down because it doesn't know what it is. And so it's very conflictual, you know. And words become part of the same thing. As my friend of mine says, you know, well, swords are just, you know, are just words, you know, and people, you know,
alphabets.
Yeah, and they get caught up in this stuff. So to the degree that we think our thinking, and thinking is a kind of airy process, you go with this stuff. And well, one of the ways that you disempower thinking is to embrace the higher element, which in the Tarot is water. And of course, water is receptivity and it's emotion. And at another, so at one level, it's the source of where a lot of this air comes up. You know, it's the source of this thing, and that gives things more of a subtlety. And of course, then if you go even deeper into that receptivity and what it is, you go into the fire, into the immediate now. Of the
and release presence. The knowing.
Yeah.
Release the knowing. Trade in the knowing
yeah.
and knowledge for innocence.
Right.
And yeah, it's in that innocence that the sense of being shifts to the immortal.
Right.
We're going to have to learn how to translate a nod on the radio to a yes, I reckon. Because
it's
nodding is not working too well here.
Yeah, that's right. Tom's been sitting back here nodding back and forth. So if you hear this sort of this in and out going at the that's Tom's beard rushing up against the microphone. But okay, Tom, what do you got to say that can continue to push us in the same direction?
Again, like now, speaking for myself, there's something in me that will not let me stop my search. I mean, I know I've been there, I've had my experiences, but I keep trying to really attain that sense of tranquility at all times.
Mm-hmm.
Joel Goldsmith, you touched on part of it a while ago about not reacting mm-hmm. when somebody's angry or something. Joel Goldsmith commented that, number one, all there is God. Number two, take everything that happens impersonally while realizing that this is all an illusion. It's a structure of our concepts, you know. And I know that. I've read it tons. I mean, I've experienced it. But trying to apply it in my day-to-day life
mm-hmm.
is a bugbear. I mean,
yeah.
I have actually seen what I would call miracles occur.
Right.
You know, when I, in a sense, resisted the impulse to strike back or I put up my sword, you know.
Right.
Rather than fighting it, I just said, okay, I don't understand it. It just is. You know, and then poof, situation just dissolved. I mean, I was amazed. And it took me several years to realize that I had actually applied spiritual principles to a condition that was really affecting me. So I know these principles work. I don't have a clue where it's leading me. I don't know where I'll be next week, next month, next year. You know, but I know that there's something within me pushing me on to try to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And right now my understanding is not knowing. It's just to absolutely get to a place of not knowing and trusting in that.
Yeah, that being. Which searches.
And in good old English sense, you know, the cloud of unknowing. There's
yes.
a point where it's not so much you not know. It's not a diminution of knowledge. It's an unknowing. It sort of unravels like a knot. It sort of loosens itself up so that instead of being a knot of knowing. I always used to walk around and I felt that my head was this big knot. This big, and everything I thought of was this sort of, you know, like tied, you know, up just stuck in my head, you know, and I was just walking around, you know, and I was sort of suffocating on this knot of my head walking around. And I hated this knot, you know, I was wanting to have that knot just loosen up. Well, eventually it does, you know, and one of the ways you help loosen up the knot is, you know, just relax, you know, let the body come through. You know? Yeah.
The knot.
Like a fist, yeah.
It's like a fist. And
yeah.
if you clench your fist, it takes on an identity all of its mm-hmm. own. And to relax, when you open your fist, that feeling is gone.
Mm-hmm.
The knot of separation with ego we all carry.
Yeah.
And when we're threatened in any way, maybe it's an intimate disturbance or maybe it's something mortal disturbance, mm-hmm. that knot will contract. And that knot is the one of the best places in your life that you can work on yourself, because if you put attention onto that knot,
mm-hmm.
that is the ego. That's the personality, the ego,
mm-hmm.
the narrator, I. Put your attention right on it,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's called self-inquiry. Mm-hmm. And that knot will dissolve, and then you'll be aware of the incredible depth of peace in who you are within which that knot has arisen.
Okay, so now the question is, for clarification, how do you put your attention onto this knot? You feel the burden of this egotism. How do I attend to it? How do I pay attention to it? How do I question it?
Totally accept it. Totally accept it. Go right to that, the knot itself.
That loosens that. The self-acceptance,
accepting that pain. You'll realize that you're pinching yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then you relax that fist.
And it doesn't hurt so much anymore.
But there's also the right identification that goes along with that.
Mm-hmm.
And by right identification, I mean realizing that we are this beingness. We are this...
The being that Trent...
Yeah.
Within which the knot arose.
Right. We are that.
This awareness. So the awareness, in some ways, it's my awareness that I'm tying up into too limited a thing. And with the same awareness, it can help me relax so that that knot becomes unraveled eventually.
And go away.
It'll go away. That's unraveled, right? Yeah, it'll go away eventually.
Then no matter what happens, the knot doesn't come back.
Somebody comes along and ties up everything again. Look at all the way that we had these headphones and stuff today. Somebody's out there messing up things no matter what happens. Yeah. Well, okay, so let's apply this to the great American economic meltdown that we're all suffering through right now.
Anyway, it's a blessing.
It's a blessing. It is a blessing. It is a blessing.
We all know it.
Yeah, yeah. It is amazing.
But, so we go, we accept it, and we go with it. Yeah. And we adjust and acclimate ourselves to the environment, and what needs to happen will happen.
Mm-hmm.
Trust again.
A well-known teacher said to me one time, every action is perfect. And as you look at that, if thy will or God's will is true,
mm-hmm.
it manifests itself without obstruction. There can't be any of it. Is as it is. And in the here and now, if we accept the here and now, and that we truly can't make a real decision, then it puts that I out of a job.
Mm-hmm.
And from not employing the I narrator, then life still goes on. It still unfolds just like it would before, except you're not carrying the burden of doership.
Well, as old codgers, who relatively unencumbered, I can see how this would be. But if I'm a young guy, and I've got a wife, and I got some kids, and I had a job, and now I don't have a job. You know, I mean, those are some pretty heavy-duty, encumbrances that we carry in ourselves.
Joel Goldsmith talks about, in the spiritual interpretation of Scripture, Joseph that was sold into slavery, put in the, buried in the ground, his brother sold him into slavery,
mm-hmm.
But yet he went on to become Pharaoh's favorite, but the point of it was his brothers meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. So everything that is happening to us that we think is occurring is leading us on to something better, even though it may be tearing us apart in our physical, whatever we're looking at, financial structure. It is leading us to something better, just like a woman giving birth. She goes through a lot of pain, but at the end of it, she's joyous because she's something new is going on.
You can't have a coming together without a coming apart.
Well, you know, you look at the last Great Depression. I mean, just as this historical hindsight, I don't know if it's wisdom or not, but, you know, it led actually to World War II. I mean, it led to the conditions that created World War II and the rearmification of Germany and also the militarization of Japan, amongst other things. You know, even though in the process, they got a slight handle on the Great Depression before World War II, people were still struggling, and what really changed the economy around was World War II. What I really hope in this depression, however it pans out in the next few years, I hope it doesn't lead to more war. I hope it leads to a recognition that the war we have to fight is a war of becoming and creating a sustainable economy.
A green war.
Yes. that recognizes that we are responsible, because, you know, a war in the old savage way it's done is incredibly brutal and wasteful of human beings and of everything. It's a terrible thing. And of course, I am ashamed that America has started a war and has been, even in a relatively limited sense, but has created so much human suffering. It's hard when we suffer so terribly and so directly to find these deeper serenities that we've been talking about today. There's a lot more we could say with you guys. I do have one last show that is unscheduled. If you guys want to come back and wish me fare-thee well, which will be in I guess it's the 29th or something like that, which is, I think, the last show. This is a couple of weeks. So if you're around, if you want to come by, I'll be just sitting around here talking about how enlightened I am. And maybe you can keep me down to reality.
The 29th.
The 29th is my final. This is the farewell show of full things. And actually, one of the things we can do is John Troy's got a new book coming out. It'll be available after the first of the year. It's going to be called Wisdom Soft Whisper. Is that the title going to be?
Yes.
And you'll be able to get it through Amazon and other places.
Amazon,
like that.
Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
Borders.
And it's a. You know, and you get a chance, Wizard Baldur, which is one of John Troy's alter egos.
Yeah.
And we have to talk about why you have an alter ego when ultimately you're no self or whatever, or the self, or however you want to call
it. We all have a storyline.
Yeah, storyline.
And that's the horizontal paradigm.
We also
have the spiritual aspect, which is the vertical paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
So they're both there.
Yeah, well, this is good. I've been using that metaphor ad nauseum lately in a various contexts of vertical and horizontal. So next week we got another friend coming in, and then one last show before we put a nice ending, at least temporarily, to Touchstones for a while. Thank you for tuning in, and let's take